We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin has its share of wonderful museums that tell the stories of the past, from the Milwaukee Public Museum to the Wisconsin Civil War Museum. But there is one museum where you can literally walk through Milwaukee's history. The Chudnow Museum of yesteryear is only a year old itself, but presents Milwaukee as it was in the interwar period and focuses on the material culture of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. Located in a converted house at 11th and Kilbourne, the museum's rooms become the literal locales that show a city in transition. And each one is filled to the brim with historic tools, bottles, posters, and other seeming ephemera that were painstakingly collected and preserved by one Milwaukee man. Director Steve Daly gives Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce a tour and explains the museum's origins.
This is the lifelong collection of one man, Avram M. Chudnow, and he was a local businessman who took it upon himself to collect Americana, basically, social material culture of society. He collected all these different artifacts and objects that kind of document American culture. Kind of shows the consumerism, the rise of industrialization and the population during that time period.
And with the rise of that consumerism, there seems to be an increase in maybe that throwaway culture that Mr. Chudnow was kind of trying to preserve.
Yeah, for whatever reason, he decided early on to save the things that most of us would have put in the garbage a long time ago, like empty candy wrappers and cardboard boxes and tin cans. He saved them. And some of them he saved with contents still in them, and some of them luckily are empty, so we've had to discard some of the petrified contents out of some of the boxes or cans, but for the most part, most of them are empty.
Well, Steve, where are we standing right now?
Well, right now we're standing in our recreation of Wonderland Park, which was Milwaukee's version, if you will, of Coney Island or Six Flags. At one time, Milwaukee had this great amusement park that had a Ferris wheel, a carousel, roller coaster. It even had a water slide called Shoot the Chutes. It would have been in today's Hubbard Park if it was still around, but unfortunately there's no signs of Wonderland anywhere left. So what we're showing off in here is an ice cream parlor that would have been in Wonderland Park because they would have sold ice cream, and we're featuring Lueck ice cream, which was a major Milwaukee dairy at the time period, and John Lueck came up with two innovations for ice cream that really made Lueck a name in the nation. The first thing he did was came out with a process to freeze ice cream in bricks and put it in take-home cartons, much like a Chinese take-home box today. And the other thing was he came up with a process to make more than the standard strawberry, vanilla, and chocolate flavors. He came up with the idea, why can't we have fruits and nuts and things like that in ice cream? And before that time period, I guess it would mess up the machinery when you tried to add those things. Well, he came up with a way that he could do it, and other ice cream makers from across the nation came to visit him and learn how to do his process. So you can thank John Lueck for all your different chunky monkeys and cookie dough ice cream.
Why do this kind of three-dimensional recreation where you can literally sit on the stools, where people can actually put themselves into the scene?
We believe in the immersion exhibit, so where you can actually walk into it and experience the exhibit, much like the streets of old Milwaukee were a little bit more than that, that you can walk into the store, you can walk into the location and see what's on display rather than just look through a window and see it that way. We've just left the Wonderland Park and the ice cream fountain, and now we've walked to the neighborhood hardware store. And so we're showing off some of the hardware items that would have been available for people to buy at the time period. And some of the major things in this exhibit are the electrical objects. The United States was going through a massive electrification process at the time period. Everybody wanted electricity. And obviously, if you create a new product like electricity, there's companies that come along and create a demand for electricity. So you create electric toasters, you create electric irons, percolators, egg cookers, pants pressers, you name it, they make it. So we're just showing off some of those products that became available in the 1920s.
What is it about objects like these that help you to bring people into the past, to tell them these stories about what Milwaukee was like at this time period.
It's my opinion that it's through these objects that we can tell the story better because, for instance, showing a toaster, everybody can relate to a toaster. Although ours looks much different than your modern toaster, once we describe how it works, you get the general idea of the principle involved or the coffee maker or the electric iron. It's just a way of showing people that this is how history goes. And I think that's a way to do it with three-dimensional objects like this. And we're fortunate that Mr. Chudnow saved a lot of this stuff that probably would have long time ago ended up in the landfill somewhere.
As we're finishing our errands, we've just gone to the hardware store. Where are we now?
Now we've walked into the local neighborhood grocery store, and this is the H. Groffman Grocery Store, which is the other side of the Chudnow family. Mr. Chudnow was married to Anita Groffman, and this was her parents' grocery store at 603 Valeet Street. This would have been a place that you would have shopped almost every day. There were ones throughout the city. I think they estimate there were like 260 neighborhood grocers throughout Milwaukee in the 1920s. They all catered to their clientele, so there were German grocers, there were Polish grocers, Italian grocers. We feel that during the Depression, it's probably because of grocers that keeping people on the books. You know, they didn't have credit cards back then, but because they let people buy things and take it home, but just keep it on the book, so to speak, not pay for it, but pay for it hopefully in the future, that they kept a lot of families fed. Because if it wasn't for them, a lot of families probably would have gone hungry. So they let them carry their bills for months at a time before they paid it off.
I'm really impressed at the fact that Mr. Chudnow had this vision that he would keep some of these things.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible that somebody had that kind of vision, and I think we're fortunate there are people like that who seem to recognize, for whatever reason, they seem to recognize that somebody needs to save this stuff, because most of these items in here would have been thrown out long ago. I mean, let's face it, how many of us would have saved an old Quaker Oats carton or a Carnation malted milk box or a Red Star yeast box or whatever? I mean, we would have thrown those out a long time ago, but he saw the need to collect and save these things. He labeled himself a conservator. That's what he called himself. And I think that's probably a pretty apt term for him. I mean, I think he felt like he was conserving this stuff for the future. And I think he really did.
Well, where to next?
Well, the next room we're going to walk into is our transportation exhibit. We've got a recreation of Union Depot, which was the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railway Depot that was sort of in the Menominee Valley area, sort of around Pottawatomie Bingo in that general vicinity. And so we're showcasing transportation and the various changes that happened in the 1920s. The car starts to slowly take over and the train starts a slow decline that doesn't stop until about the 1960s.
Tell us about who we're looking at.
Well, we have a porter, an African-American porter, and what we're showing here is the African-Americans' participation in the Porters Union, the United Brotherhood of Railroad Workers. And this is a big deal for African-Americans because this was a prime job if you were an African-American male. This was a good middle-class job for African-Americans at a time period when a lot of them were basically relegated to basically hard physical labor, and they didn't make a whole lot of money. Whereas an African-American porter, he made about $875 in 1920s money, which at the time period was a little bit below the average worker. I think they made about $1,200, so he wasn't making quite as much, but it was still a significant amount for an African-American worker. And they were looked upon in their neighborhood as being a role model for people. You know, that was a prime job, and they were kind of considered a person who had made it. They had made the American dream.
Who else was living in Milwaukee at this time?
Well, Milwaukee was made up of a lot of different ethnic groups: Germans, Poles, Irish, Italian, Eastern Europeans, Irish. You know, so it was a mixture of people. Germans probably the most numerous at the time period, but at the end of the First World War, Milwaukee started to lose its identity as a German city. Before that time period, German was spoken on the streets. They had German newspapers, they had German plays, operas. After the First World War and during the First World War, a lot of that changed. Obviously, they had to keep a lower profile.
Now let's take a trip to Bayview. We're going to Bayview Drugstore. What do we see here in this room? What is on display here?
Well, what we've recreated in here is a typical pharmacy from the 1920s. Medicine and pharmacy is undergoing a lot of changes in the 20s. Before 1920, there were a lot of patent medicines sold over the counter or through catalogs. And patent medicines were basically concoctions or elixirs that different companies sold to people that cured everything from hiccups to cancer. Honestly, most of them didn't do any of those things. And the three major ingredients that seemed to be in most of these concoctions were cocaine, heroin, and alcohol.
Wow.
So you can imagine that most of the patients who took these things were basically covering up the problem. They weren't really solving anything. And chances are, if you took it long enough, you probably became addicted to the elixir that you would take.
I guess that's one way to get a repeat customer.
Yes, the pharmacies would sell a lot of this stuff, or the catalogs would. But starting in the 1920s, the Food and Drug Administration started clamping down on the patent medicine companies for selling these products, and they started requiring that these ingredients, these three ingredients, would be either taken out, or the quantities or the strength of it would be lessened so that people wouldn't be receiving the doses that they were.
Well, I see that there's a clinic upstairs. Shall we head to that?
Yeah, we can go up to the second floor of the building and you'll get a chance to see the other part of the house. And this is the first room at the top of the stairs on the second floor. This was Dr. Joseph Eisenberg's clinic. And so what we're showcasing in here, at one time Dr. Eisenberg owned this building from about the mid-20s to about the mid-1950s, and he was a general practitioner who graduated from Marquette's medical school. We've documented that through some research. He operated it as a home clinic.
It's pretty interesting given where we're located just a couple blocks from Aurora Sinai Hospital.
Yeah, I mean, we're in the neighborhood of a mega hospital, but back in the 1920s, there weren't a lot of those type of institutions, so a lot of these clinics or infirmaries kind of filled in for that when there was a need for people to be able to go somewhere and be taken care of.
Well, this next room is fairly colorful.
Yeah, what we're displaying in here are toys of the time period. So we've got a shop window here. We're calling it Grand Avenue Toys. You can use your imagination. It could have been Gimbel's or Schuster's, one of the big department stores of the time period. But it's showcasing some of the products that were available to the families at that time period. This was the advent of the board game. Families were able to spend more free time at home together playing games. With the eight-hour workday and the ability of mothers and fathers to make better incomes through different kinds of jobs, they didn't have to work long hours, they didn't have to work from sun up to sundown every night. They did have some free time to spend with their kids, and this was a chance for them to sit around the table, play a game, and get to know each other a little bit and find out that maybe dad has a sense of humor and mom's not such a bad person either, and find out what their kids are into. So it's a way to educate our visitors that mass production of games and consumerism, if you will, we're really kind of showing off consumerism here, that this was a way that the American family was kind of evolving in the time period.
Well, right off of the toy store, we have Saks Theater, I guess another place where families would go to get entertainment.
Yeah, the 20s is the advent of the talking picture, the big movie palaces, if you will. And so what we're showing in this room, we've kind of taken the Saks brothers as our model because they owned a lot of the really big movie palaces in town. And so we're just calling this the Saks Theater, kind of a generic name. We show movies of the time period like 1931 Frankenstein at Halloween. We show Shirley Temple movies, For Whom the Bell Tolls, you know, different films of the 20s and 30s.
Well, let me ask you, just how many items does the museum have on display and then also in its possession?
Well, currently on display we have 700 items. We estimate, and this is purely an estimate at this point, that there's over 250,000 items in Mr. Chudnow's collection.
Wow, that's a lot. How do you even begin to go through that and figure out what's worth displaying and what's not?
Yeah, it's a big effort, and my hope is as we go forward, we can make an online museum catalog so people can see what's in the collection. And then we can maybe offer some of these items on loan to other area museums. So it could be a way that we can expand the reach of this museum by showing off some of the great stuff that Mr. Chudnow collected. And then there's a room up on the second floor that I consider a changing exhibit room that I want to put in some new and varied objects so that we can keep making this a fresh experience for people. When visitors come through, they can say, well, I was here 6 months ago, but it's not quite the same as it was when I first walked through.
Steve Daly is the director of the Chudnow Museum of Yesteryear, located right near 11th and Kilbourne in Milwaukee. Tomorrow marks its Founders Day in honor of Avram Michael Chudnow, whose collection comprises the museum. There'll be half-price admission all day from 10 to 4, guest speakers, and a new documentary on Mr. Chudnow in the theater. You can find more information from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect, and you can also listen there to plenty more from our audio tour, including a trip to a speakeasy. That is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
That's the Broadway Mellow.